Hello, this is Patricia from North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Time Magazine's June 22 through 29, 2020 edition features a cover photograph with a red border, white inner edge, large capital letter spelling out T-I-M-E, Time. A caption near the bottom of the cover says The Overdue Awakening, and the cover is by Devin Allen. It's a photograph, and its caption indicates a protester speaking at a Black Trans Lives Matter rally in Baltimore, June 5. It looks like an alleyway with a sea of people standing, sitting, and lying on the asphalt amidst this canyon of tall buildings. There's a bus in the mid-foreground and more vehicles in the background and lots of signs that proclaim Black Lives Matter, No Justice, No Peace. And there is someone at the very front of the photograph. Only his back is seen, or her back is seen, a very short haircut on a person of color holding a bullhorn, speaking to the crowd who are mostly prone on the ground. Moving into the text now of this Time Magazine issue. The View, Health, Science in a Pandemic. Research is normally a plodding, tedious process. Scientists check and recheck their data, review and re-review their conclusions, and then submit their hard work to a scientific journal for publication where their peers put it through further scrutiny. But a viral pandemic does not adhere to a cautious timeline. This is by Alice Park. The View opener, as COVID-19 has raced across the globe, public health experts, public officials, doctors, patients scrambled to find answers about the disease. Digital sites that posted manuscripts of scientific papers before peer review have flourished since January, and editors of prestigious medical journals have asked their peer reviewers to complete their analyses, traditionally done over weeks, in just days. That pressure to publish is exposing the tension between the desire within the scientific community to only release information once it has been fully vetted, a process that takes weeks and months, and the urgent public need for actionable information in the midst of a devastating pandemic. It is not simply an academic matter for those in the research community. Increasingly, policymakers have turned to the scientific process to guide their decisions, not to mention the doctors who trust it for finding ways to treat their patients and save lives. The result is a confusing and often contradictory set of messages from public health experts. On June 8, a World Health Organization expert declared COVID-19 spreading from people without any symptoms was very rare, then admitted a day later the conclusion was a misunderstanding and based on only a few studies. The concern over asymptomatic spread is a major reason behind social distancing practices and advice for people to wear face masks in public. Ever-changing public health advice is the cost of quickly collecting, digesting, and making sense of information about a completely new virus. For doctors treating patients with COVID-19, the pressures of managing a pandemic illness are exacerbated by the fact that their North Star for treatment decisions, peer-reviewed reports in medical journals, are also facing steep challenges in finding ways to publish reliable information with far less time than they're accustomed to having. In early June, for example, scientists from prestigious academic research institutes retracted two papers related to COVID-19, one involving hydroxychloroquine and other investigating blood pressure medications, which were both based on data supposedly from patients in hundreds of hospitals on six continents. The scientists decided to pull the papers after the data collection company they used refused to provide the peer reviewers the full set of data. Without a doubt, in the rush to produce manuscripts for peer review, I am concerned investigators may be under the same pressure to rush their studies as journals are to publish them, said Dr. Howard Bauchner, editor-in-chief of JAMA. In calmer times, prestigious journals such as JAMA vet every submission through a team of editors and peer review experts over several months. During this pandemic, however, the volume of papers has surged, and there's no way for a traditional peer review process to keep up with that, says Jonathan Eisen, professor of evolution and ecology at the University of California, Davis. Rather than wait, scientists are funneling dozens of COVID-19 papers daily to preprint servers or online repositories for scientific manuscripts that have not yet been peer-reviewed. That is raising concerns about the risks of publishing unvetted studies related to patient care. If there are mistakes in those studies, there's no capacity or limited capacity to correct them, says Bauchner. But it may be time to modify the scientific process so it can be more agile at providing experts with critical and reliable information in a timely manner, encouraging researchers to openly share data used in their studies, for example, would allow more scientists to quickly evaluate the validity of their results. Eisen, who serves on the advisory board of a preprint database, is also in favor of making the peer review system more transparent and boosting the number of reviewers by asking graduate students and other qualified people to quickly audit studies. There's no doubt the pandemic is making it easier for bad players to play badly, but it's also easier for good players to play well, he says. After isolation, a plague of loneliness. Americans were already lonely, then COVID-19 hit. This is by Jamie Ducharme. It's accompanied by a photograph, which appears to be during the nighttime, although the photo is taken under a very large leafy tree, so it may be just that the dimness is attributable to the shade of the tree. A woman is standing wearing dark clothing, leaning against a very tall, probably 8 feet high, dark-colored fence, wooden fence. And behind her and the fence stands a house. It's also a dark color, unless it is actually nighttime while this photo was taken. Two windows are lit. The other windows, which are seen in the photo, are dark. The caption reads, Katrin Glado at home with her family during the COVID-19 outbreak in New Orleans, April 28. Driving around her Kearney, Missouri neighborhood is both respite and torture for Kathy Hodgson. She likes seeing other people out and about. It reminds her what life was like before COVID-19. But Hodgson, a 41-year-old teacher who lives alone after a recent divorce, says seeing happy families playing in their yards or walking their dogs can also send her plunging deep into a spiral of loneliness. You know, as much as I have valued my independence in the past year, it's finally hitting me that I would like to curl up on the couch with somebody at night, Hodgson says. The irony, Hodgson notes, is she was thrilled to live alone before the coronavirus pandemic hit, enjoying her me time and the newfound ability to date and see friends whenever she wanted. But now that she's confined to her apartment almost 24 hours a day, she's feeling the emptiness of her home acutely. Some days I smile and feel okay, Hodgson says, and other days I curl up in a ball and wonder if this goes on too much longer, will I be able to take it mentally? Can I last sanely living alone for months, a year? Even before the COVID-19 pandemic, public health experts were concerned about an epidemic of loneliness in the U.S. The coronavirus has exacerbated that problem, with most face-to-face socializing still limited to members of people's own households. For the 35.7 million Americans who live alone, that means no meaningful social contact at all, potentially for months on end. Experts are rightly concerned about the mental health ramifications of this widespread isolation, especially since there's no agreed-upon tipping point at which acute loneliness transitions into a chronic problem with long-term consequences. A group of doctors from Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School even warned in an April 22 commentary in the Annals of Internal Medicine that physical distancing and stress caused by the pandemic, combined with rising firearm sales, could worsen the suicide crisis the U.S. has been weathering for more than a decade. But some mental health advocates are optimistic COVID-19 will finally give loneliness the mainstream recognition it deserves, possibly paving the way for a more socially connected future. For such a common experience, loneliness is surprisingly slippery to define clinically. Loneliness is not included in the DSM-5, the official diagnostic manual for mental health disorders, but it goes hand in hand with many conditions that are. It is often lumped together with social isolation. But the two concepts are different. Social isolation is an objective indicator of how much contact somebody has with other people, whereas loneliness is the subjective feeling of isolation, says Dr. Carla Perisinotto, a geriatrician at University of California, San Francisco, who studies loneliness. Being alone does not necessarily mean you are lonely, nor does it mean being around people mean you're not, Perisinotto says. Loneliness is a feeling only the person experiencing it can identify. It can also be difficult to untangle whether loneliness is a symptom or a cause of a larger health issue. Do people withdraw socially because they're depressed, or do they become depressed because they are lonely? In any case, studies show chronic loneliness has clear links to an array of health problems, including dementia, depression, anxiety, self-harm, heart conditions, and substance abuse. People without social support also have lower chances of full recovery after a serious illness than people with a strong network, studies show. The health consequences of loneliness are often likened to the effects of smoking 15 cigarettes a day, and they're far more common. While the most recent data show 14% of U.S. adults smoke cigarettes, a January report from health insurer Cigna suggested around 60% felt some loneliness before the pandemic. After stay-at-home orders were instated, roughly a third of American adults reported feeling lonelier than usual, according to an April survey by social advice company SocialPro. Another April survey for financial research group Value Penguin put the number even higher, at 47%. Chronic loneliness may have seen a smaller bump. A June JAMA study found 14% of U.S. adults always or often felt lonely. in April 2020 compared with 11% in 2018. If the stereotype of a lonely person is a frail elderly adult living alone, the pandemic has exposed the truth that was there all along. Anyone, anywhere, of any age can experience loneliness. SocialPro's survey of 1,228 adults found that at least 20% in each age group were lonelier than usual as a result of coronavirus. Millennials were among the most likely to feel lonely before COVID-19, research shows, and that's no different now. 34% of millennials in the survey said they were always or often lonelier because of the pandemic. Gender was not a predictor either. About 25% of women and 30% of men said they felt corona-related loneliness. Nor does one's living situation necessarily dictate feelings. Katrin Gladow, 41, the person in the photo, has spent the past few months at home in New Orleans with her husband and three young kids, but she says she's never felt more alone. She says she has zero emotional energy for self-care while juggling work, parenting, paralyzing stress and anxiety and grief from losing people in her community to coronavirus. There's also guilt for feeling overwhelmed when so many people are worse off, she says. Even in a house full of screaming children who I love more than anything, I feel especially vulnerable, Gladow said. She feels pressure to be the glue of the family, and I'm trying not to let them down, but in the process, I'm crumbling. And of course, elderly adults do remain at high risk of loneliness. Given their susceptibility to serious COVID-19 infections, older adults are now likely to be even more cut off from outside life. NORC at the University of Chicago found the pandemic has made about a third of adults, 70 and older, lonelier than usual. In other words, loneliness is everywhere, especially now. This is a huge topic, but it's been kind of sidelined, Sparisi Noto said. Now everyone's forced to look at this in a different way. We cannot keep ignoring this. Technology has emerged as an imperfect solution. Video chat platforms like Zoom are surging in popularity, and nearly every social media network is billing itself as a way to stay connected with friends virtually. Telecom companies like Samsung have donated smart devices to help people in quarantine stay connected. There are also community groups attempting to make digital communication more meaningful. Some existed before COVID-19 but have expanded to meet surging demand, like Let's Be Authentic, a Philadelphia area social group that pairs up members for weekly video chats and communication exercises. It has seen a noticeable uptick in use of its online programs, a company representative says. And the Maryland Department of Aging is piloting a program in which any elderly person who signs up gets a personalized weekly phone call from a volunteer. They know someone is there for them should they need it, and that alone makes you feel good, says Department Secretary Rona Kramer. Other groups have popped up in direct response to the crisis. A team of Cornell students built the platform Quarantine Buddy to match up users with similar interests for virtual conversations and has so far attracted at least 8,000 people in 64 countries, ranging in age from 18 to 80. But research suggests not everyone benefits equally from digital interactions. Several studies found that tools like video chats and instant messages may help elderly adults feel less lonely, especially if they're physically isolated from others and cannot otherwise socialize. Yet, interestingly, research shows that loneliness may subside for younger adults when they reduce their social media usage. In regular life, that may be because endless scrolling through other people's social media posts makes young people left out. feel left out, or it may be because it is replacing valuable in-person moments. Under COVID-19 lockdown, social media may simply serve as a painful reminder of their loved one's physical absence. In Value Penguin's recent survey, 10% of respondents said video chats only make them feel lonelier. Jessica Flugrath, a 27-year-old freelance writer and editor who lives alone in Brooklyn, has been using video chats to stay connected with her friends, but she says they bring a nagging feeling of unease. The ebb and flow of an in-person conversation does not always translate to video, and she does not like the pressure of having to be on all the time. She also does not like how easily digital conversations lend themselves to distraction. There is a lack of feeling present with people in general, she says. But with few other options available, people should probably make the best of virtual platforms, says Rudolf Tonzi, vice chair of neurology and director of genetics and aging research unit at Massachusetts General Hospital. Stress related to loneliness can trigger inflammation in the body, he says, which in turn is linked to a host of chronic conditions. Social interaction is just as important for quelling that stress response as physical behaviors like getting enough sleep, exercising, practicing yoga or meditation, and following a balanced diet, he says. We use the term social distancing, but it is completely the wrong term. Tonzi says you want physical distancing. That does not exclude social interaction via some of these internet platforms. How much emotional benefit you get from virtual communication may come down to your mindset, says Jenny Tates, an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at University of California, Los Angeles. If we write off a friend texting us, she says, we're not going to be able to enjoy or savor the dose of connection they're offering us. Studies have shown feeling socially supported can make a measurable difference for mental health, regardless of how much socializing you are actually doing. Christine Marie Lewog-Dixon, 30, has had years of practice communicating virtually. Most of Dixon's family are in the Philippines, but she and her husband live in the New York suburbs, so extended family gatherings are rare. I have more than a dozen cousins, and we've never all been in the same room, she says. For years, Dixon has had to get by on small gestures of love, like a text or a picture of an especially good meal. That can be enough if you frame it right, she says. Even little, sporadic reminders like that remind us that no matter how far apart we are, even if we do not see each other regularly, we still love each other. We're still connected. We're still a family. But for truly lasting change, the healthcare system also needs to buy in. A February report from National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine concluded health professionals should be screening seniors for loneliness and entering warning signs into patients' medical records, just like any other condition. In the wake of COVID-19, that may become a best practice for patients of all ages. The report's authors also called on the government and health insurers to fund research into loneliness and pushed for awareness campaigns about the scope of the problem among people of all ages. What can help now? Mindfulness training and cognitive behavioral therapy can be valuable anti-loneliness tools for people young or old. Since reframing the way one perceives social support can make an appreciable difference in feelings of loneliness, Tates said. These techniques can be easily taught over telehealth platforms. At the very least, COVID-19 is making loneliness easier to talk about, which could encourage people who struggle with it to seek help or reach out to connections they do have, Perry Sinoto said. There's a certain amount of stigma attached to any mental illness, but loneliness can be uniquely uncomfortable to talk about. It can feel like a person failing to admit if you don't have the social network you want. And there's a tendency for others to blame the victim, Perry Sinoto says. In one 1992 Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin study, participants rated a fictional lonely person as less likable, social, competent and attractive than a non-lonely person. Experts hope the fact that loneliness is now mainstream and easier than ever to talk about will finally change that perception. Claire Lejeune, a 24-year-old photographer who lives in Los Angeles, says she is not a lonely person by nature. Her job, after all, involves being around people, and she's active and social in her personal life. But when two of her roommates left her apartment to shelter in place elsewhere, and the third began keeping mostly to himself, she says she found herself truly lonely for the first time she could remember, and somewhat uncomfortable with that realization. I am privileged and not doing as terribly as some people are in quarantine. I felt kind of bad to even say I'm lonely, because it's like, oh, woe is she, Lejeune says. But when she tweeted about her feelings, she says she was met with a wave of support from people going through the same thing. There was definitely a sense of community within the loneliness, she says. Everyone can relate to it. This page is captioned, Time Off Food. Chef tasted baking subs by Raisa Bruner. As the weeks of stay-at-home orders around the U.S. press on, baking has surged as a popular means to keep families fed and to while away the hours. At the same time, the strain on the home kitchen is clear. We are limiting trips to the grocery store while markets and vendors are adjusting to changing demands and disrupted supply chains. School meal services and food banks are working overtime to help provide meals and supplies for those battling food insecurity. Inevitable product shortages can make food preparation all the more difficult, but a few innovative swaps can mean a missing ingredient here or there won't throw off your baking plans. For advice, time turned to Alyssa Wagner, chef and co-founder of New York City restaurant Dimes, the Great American Baking Show winner Valerie Lomas, and pastry chef and Milk Bar founder Christina Tosi. Bread substitutes, yeast-free options, cornbread, focaccia, other flours, whole wheat, rice, chickpea, oat. Despite flour and yeast shortages, homemade carbs are within reach. Cornbread fits the bill, as do yeast-free options like focaccia. Tosi turns to beer bread, since beer already has yeast in it. Subs for all-purpose flour abound. Rice or chickpea flours are common in gluten-free recipes and can be used widely. Lomas has been using whole wheat. Nut flours are great in cookies. Tosi even suggests ingredients that can be ground, like popcorn. Eggs. Substitutes. Tofu, applesauce, mashed bananas, flaxseed meal for egg whites. Aquafaba, water, in a can of chickpeas. Eggs are difficult to match in taste as a standalone food, but for baking, do as the vegans do. Swap in applesauce or another fruit. Mashed bananas are a common choice. Or a neutral flavored oil can provide structure and moisture. Lomas and Tosi also recommend another vegan staple, the flax egg. A tablespoon of flaxseed meal soaked in water to form a jelly-like concoction. For egg whites, the liquid in a can of chickpeas called aquafaba will work to make fluffy meringue. Butter. Substitutes. Olive oil, canola oil, grapeseed oil, avocado oil, heavy cream. Oil, olive, canola, even grapeseed or avocado can be used in place of butter, as long as the flavor complements your recipe. The conversion is not one-to-one, since butter also has milk fats that oils lack. There's always old-school shortening, which best matches butter's flavor and structure, or margarine, though it is not as flavorful. For some cakes, whipped heavy cream and a longer baking time can work just as well. Sugar substitutes, maple syrup, honey. Consider liquid sweeteners like maple syrup, honey, and agave. Light brown sugar can be made by adding a splash of maple syrup to granulated sugar. Dark brown sugar requires molasses. For powdered sugar, blend granulated sugar with a pinch of cornstarch. Repurpose ingredients like marshmallows, peanut butter, or sorbet for sweetness, or look beyond sugar for flavor. Toasty throws potato chips or pretzels into cookie dough. And finally, milk substitutes. Coconut milk or nut milks like almond, cashew, or oat. There are many shelf-stable milk substitutes. Wagner likes coconut milk, which you can keep in the pantry and thin as needed with water. For bundt and loaf cakes, Tosi sometimes grabs sour cream or Greek yogurt. Making your own nut milks like cashew or almond is also an option. Wagner recommends a ratio of 3 parts water to 1 part nuts soaked overnight, blended and strained through a clean t-shirt. Tosi uses nut milks for pancakes, crepes, and bar cookies. Her sweetest milk trick? Melting down vanilla ice cream. Under the heading Nation, Inside the Movement to Defund the Police by Lisandra Villa, this will be slightly abridged. The giant yellow letters spelling out Black Lives Matter span 2 blocks just north of the White House and are visible by satellite. Democratic Mayor Muriel Bowser commissioned the mural to send a message to President Donald Trump. But some of the racial justice protesters who have flooded the streets of the Capitol wasted no time sending the mayor one of their own. Defund the police. They painted on the pavement just a few feet away. Since the May 25 killing of George Floyd, protesters have turned that message into a nationwide rallying cry. In New York City, there are growing cries from both activists and officials to cut the police department's $6 billion annual budget. And Mayor Bill de Blasio has pledged to cut an unspecified amount. In Los Angeles, Mayor Eric Garcetti announced up to a $150 million could be redirected from Los Angeles Police Department to investments in communities of color. And in Minneapolis, where Floyd was killed when a white police officer knelt on his neck for 8 minutes, 46 seconds, a veto-proof majority of the city council pledged to dismantle the troubled police department. It would become the largest city in the nation to take such a step. Defunding the police means different things to different people, but to most activists it means slashing funding for police departments and investing it instead in initiatives that benefit under-resourced communities, such as after-school programs, housing assistance, substance addiction support, and violence prevention initiatives. Others call for limiting the roles and responsibilities of police forces. Some advocates want to strip all funding and start from scratch. Among the national groups calling to defund the police are Black Lives Matter and the Movement for Black Lives, a coalition of groups that organized a day of action, encouraging supporters to press local officials on the issue. The idea of defunding the police has been an activist's playbook for years, but it's taken off amid the national uprising that followed Floyd's death. For years, activists say, the racial justice movement has worked to pass legislation to reform police behavior, pushing measures like requiring body cameras and restricting the use of force. Yet, despite scores of laws enacted within the past decade to address criminal justice, not much has changed, says Alicia Garza, founder of the Black Futures Lab and one of the women who coined the hashtag Black Lives Matter. About 1,000 people are killed by police every year, according to Mapping Police Violence, and the victims are disproportionately Black. Unlike federal legislation, which can take years to broker in a divided Congress, calls to defund the police can apply immediate pressure on local officials and police departments. In Charlotte, North Carolina, for example, City Council member Braxton Winston announced June 5 he would introduce a motion prohibiting future spending on chemical agents used to disperse protesters, while tasking a police oversight committee to review the department's spending. It was approved just 3 days later. There's always been a political ability to make these changes, Winston says. We may be in a moment where people that are in positions like mine are finally getting the political will. Critics, including many who favor police reform, say dissolving major police departments is a pipe dream that lacks broad public support. You are going to have police in New York City because it is needed for safety, Mayor de Blasio told Time June 8. But that does not mean you cannot change policing. Trump and Republican officials have seized on the rallying cry to accuse Democrats of endangering the public. But activists say America is witnessing a major shift in how we discuss spending public money to ensure public safety. People across the country, says Patrice Cullors, co-founder of Black Lives Matter and founder of Reform LA Jails, are ready for a defunding framework. An interview with bias expert Jennifer Eberhardt on the key to police reform. In her 2019 book, Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do, Stanford professor Jennifer Eberhardt examines the role that implicit bias, which she defines as the beliefs and feelings we have about social groups that can influence our decision-making and our actions, even when we are not aware of it, plays in police interactions. With law enforcement reform now in the spotlight, she spoke to Time about what could make a difference. Question: you have worked with several police departments on improving interactions between the police and communities of color. What reforms would you like to see? Answer: again, this is from Jennifer Eberhardt. A lot of police departments have these implicit bias trainings. This is a huge business now, where you have consultants who come in. But those trainings are not evaluated, so we don't know how effective they are in terms of more equitable policing. We don't actually have data. A lot of the trainings have focused on informing people about bias, but we need to focus on changing the conditions that promote bias rather than simply providing knowledge about bias. Question: can you give me an example? In Oakland, California, we were able to help the police department reduce the number of stops they were making of people who were not committing any serious crimes. We did this by pushing officers to ask themselves a simple question before each stop they made. Is this stop intelligence-led? Yes or no? What they meant by intelligence-led was, did I have prior information to tie this specific person to a particular crime? Just adding that question to the form officers complete during a stop slows them down. They're thinking, why am I considering pulling this person over? So in 2017, Oakland officers made about 32,000 stops across the city. And in 2018, with the addition of that question, they made about 19,000 stops. African American stops fell by over 43%, and the crime rate did not go up. Stopping fewer black people did not make the city more dangerous. In fact, the city became safer. Question: has any of what's happened recently made you rethink any recommendations or models you've been working with? I guess I appreciate the power of the camera more. Police departments all over the nation have these cameras now, But the vast majority of the footage from police body cameras is not being systematically examined. Oftentimes, police departments do not see the footage as data. They see it as evidence in isolated cases. My team wants to have them think about this footage as information they can use about what is happening daily. In Oakland, we've been looking at traffic stops because that is the primary way the average citizen comes into contact with the police. We found officers were professional overall, but they spoke less respectfully to black drivers than to white drivers. At the request of the police department, we came in and developed a training. And now we are looking at the officers' footage, pre- and post-training, to see if that change actually really did make a difference in how they spoke to people in real interactions on the street. Question: do you support calls to defund the police? I am a believer in police reform. There are lots of things we could do to bring about change. A call for defunding that is based on the feeling police are bad and there's nothing could be done? No, I do not support that. There's a lot that has been done that people are unaware of. There are a lot of levers that we can move to bring about more equitable policing. And the last question. In your book, you write about studies showing that in heightened situations, police made fewer mistakes than civilians. Why? In these shoot, don't shoot studies, police officers, as well as community members, are faster to shoot black people with guns than white people with guns. But police officers were less likely than normal people to shoot a black person with no gun than they were to shoot a white person with no gun. Researchers found that the more interactive use of force training officers had, the less likely they were to show a racial bias in terms of the error rate. If there is intensive training, sometimes you're also decreasing the likelihood bias can play a role. And Time's interviewer in this column was Belinda Luscombe. The caption here is The View, World, The Risk Report, Which Countries Have Handled COVID-19 Best? By Ian Bremmer. The coronavirus crisis has shifted to the Americas, according to the World Health Organization. Now is the time to reflect on which countries handled the initial outbreak response better than others, both as an example for other countries to follow and to gauge which countries are best positioned for what comes next. In that spirit, the team at Eurasia Group developed a methodology to assess key country responses across three areas: healthcare management, political response, and financial policy response. These are the standouts. Canada. The responses of the Canadian and U.S. federal governments to the coronavirus could not be more different. It is hard not to conclude Canada's universal, publicly funded approach to healthcare is better suited for handling a global pandemic. Even in things that are potentially comparable between the U.S. and Canada, say, public messaging coordination around the virus between national and local governments, or monetary support of international efforts to cooperate on pandemic responses, Canada is faring much better. And a critical component of that has to do with relying on science instead of partisan politics to guide the healthcare responses. Some academics contend it was Canada's experience, and more specifically its failures with SARS, S-A-R-S, almost 20 years ago that better prepared it for this current pandemic. Argentina. This is the most surprising entry on the list, given that Argentina has triggered its 9th financial default. Argentina registered its first coronavirus fatality March 7. By the time the government imposed a quarantine March 20, the world had caught up to the threat of the crisis, and Argentina introduced strict social distancing measures, and its citizens heeded them well. As a result, its numbers look much better than those of most of its neighbors. With the bipartisan cooperation of Argentina's governors, the coronavirus management response of Alberto Fernandez's new administration has led to a boost in approval ratings, which is critical as he fends off international creditors. Fernandez's willingness to spend on domestic stimulus might be there, but the reality of the government's finances and looming debt repayments constrains it considerably. Iceland. When people talk about the critical importance of testing, Iceland is the clearest example. Following on the heels of its first detected cases in late February, Iceland quickly instituted a broad and free testing and contact tracing regimen to identify and isolate COVID patients. With such good results, it was able to avoid a total shutdown and had a partial reopening by the middle of April. It helps if you are a country of just 364,000 people, but even then, Iceland punched above its weight. It had the highest per capita testing rate worldwide. The initial rounds of government stimulus did not have the same levels of direct new government spending as other nations, but then again, neither has the economic toll been as bad. United Arab Emirates. Making this list is hard. Making this list while also taking part in a global oil price war is even harder. But the United Arab Emirates have managed it. They have done so by adopting stringent social distancing measures and aggressive disinfection cleaning campaigns, helping to limit total deaths from coronavirus to fewer than 300. It is helpful that all COVID costs are covered by the government, irrespective of insurance status. More questionable is its decision to levy $5,500 fines on anyone who shares any medical information on social media that does not adhere to the government's narrative. A useful tool for limiting conspiracy theories, but also other kinds of speech. Greece. For a country that was finally showing signs of economic emergence from its decade-long financial crisis, the pandemic could not have hit at a worse time. But there is one major silver lining. A decade of austerity cuts had left Greece with a health infrastructure system unable to carry the weight of any significant coronavirus outbreak. So Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis saw the writing on the wall and did not hesitate. Roughly 3 weeks after Greece recorded its first coronavirus case in late February, the entire nation was in strict lockdown. What few resources the Greek state did have were directed to procuring more ICU beds and health workers. The result? Fewer than 200 COVID-related deaths. Australia. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has been one of the friendliest world leaders with Donald Trump so far, but the responses of the two could not have been more different. While Morrison shut Australia's borders only a day before the U.S. did, the coordinated response of Australian government officials across the political spectrum, and most critically, their deference to scientists, has resulted in some of the best numbers in the world. The economic stimulus the nation launched, worth more than 10% of GDP, going toward subsidizing wages, doubling unemployment benefits, and providing free child care for all, helped dramatically too. South Korea. South Korea's aggressive early response to the COVID-19 crisis has helped the nation maintain not just a low fatality count, but also a low overall case count, around 0.02% of the population, that remains the envy of major industrial democracies. Its continued vigilance, extensive testing and contact tracing, and isolation and treatment of confirmed cases remain a model that most other countries can only aspire to. South Korea has considerable economic and technological resources at its disposal. Sizable government stimulus, which includes cash payments to most citizens, is helping the country's population ride out the economic turbulence. The result for President Moon Jae-in, record approval ratings. Taiwan. Taiwan has managed a truly admirable response in less than ideal circumstances, despite being next door to China. Rather than shuttering its economy for weeks on end in an attempt to slow the virus, the self-governing island went another way. After quickly closing its borders and banning exports of surgical masks, the government used contact tracing and mobile SIM tracking to ensure those in quarantine were actually abiding by the rules. Taiwan has a single-payer healthcare system. Medical officials held briefings for the public daily, and businesses were kept open with aggressive precautionary measures like taking temperatures and providing sanitizer before patrons could enter. Taiwan's response ranks among the world's best. New Zealand. When it comes to a global pandemic, it helps to be an island nation, tucked away in a far-flung corner of the globe. But New Zealand's rise in the rankings results from so much more than good geographic fortune. Its first case was detected February 28, and Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern moved swiftly, instituting a level 4 lockdown, which meant people could interact only with others within their homes in an attempt to eliminate the virus altogether, and now the country is COVID-19 free. Also helping? A promise by the PM that no one would lose their residence if they lost work, a tax reform package aimed at helping small businesses, and the symbolic yet still appreciated move by Ardern and her ministers to take a 20% pay cut. Singapore. Singapore was among the first countries hailed as a winner among national pandemic responses. A well-deserved reputation on the back of its aggressive approach to contact tracing and widespread testing. In retrospect, Singapore was well-positioned to outperform others in its response, given previous lessons learned from the SARS epidemic, its small size, 5.7 million people, and centralized nanny state approach. Singapore's response was tarnished by a secondary outbreak centered in overcrowded housing, highlighting the awful living conditions with as many as 20 people sleeping in the same room, endured by the city's hundreds of thousands of migrant workers. Still, the government's sizable stimulus packages, totaling almost 20% of GDP, are admirable. A bulletin in border standoff, India and China try to keep the peace. Generals from India and China met high in the Himalayas June 6 for talks aimed at defusing border tensions between the world's two most populous nations. Each nuclear-armed side has accused the other of provocations along their 2,000-mile disputed border. China believes a new Indian road near the border upends the balance of power. Indian hawks say China has moved troops into their territory. In early May, fistfights broke out between soldiers. Weeks on, officials are still trying to stop the scuffles from escalating into a shooting war. Although troops from both sides reportedly pulled back in some places June 9, the situation remains tense. Accurate information is hard to come by, but analysts say there's been a Chinese buildup of military hardware behind the line of actual control in some areas, with troops patrolling on the Indian side. A mutual agreement not to use weapons in border clashes appears to have held so far, but observers do not know how long that will last. The problem, experts say, is that with strongmen leading both countries, the situation is more volatile than usual. What you have is essentially two very nationalistic administrations under Chinese President Xi and Indian Prime Minister Modi, says Steve Tsang, director of the China Institute at SOAS. I don't think either wants to engage in a military conflict with the other, but neither government wants to be seen as backing down either. For Modi, the situation is especially tricky. Analysts say an Indian intelligence failure may have allowed the Chinese encroachment, and India is also the underdog, both militarily and economically. But Modi has cultivated an image at home as a security-first leader, so cannot be seen to back down. One possible way to save that reputation, play to Indian disdain for foreign help. President Trump offered to mediate what he called the raging dispute May 27, but so far that offer has not been taken up. And this column was written by Billy Perigo. North Korea stops talking to South Korea. Pyongyang said June 9 it would cut off all lines of communication with South Korea and start treating the nation as an enemy. Relations between the two have deteriorated since nuclear negotiations with President Trump collapsed in February 2019. Election trouble in Georgia. Primary elections in Georgia were marred by hours-long waits and problems with new voting machines, June 9, prompting the Georgia Secretary of State to open an investigation and summoning echoes of the state's disputed governor's race in 2018. Some of the worst issues occurred in majority African-American areas. There's a catastrophic current when diesel fuel was spilled into the Amburnaya River from a heat and power plant June 6 in the Siberian city of Norilsk, N-O-R-I-L-S-K. Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered a state of emergency to help support the effort, but conservation groups warned such an incident could still take years to clean up and could have a devastating effect on the delicate Arctic environment. And this photo shows a river current. The left side is blue and the right side is yucky gray. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, and I'm reading for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.